On that note, we're going to be in Nehemiah chapter 11 talking about something that has nothing to do with Mother's Day, as I mentioned earlier. I didn't plan it that way, but that's how it worked out. And we've been in this series in Nehemiah, and I know I've got a few of you that haven't been able to be here in the past, so I'm going to give you just I'll try to do the briefest of rundowns. We've been going one chapter at a time through Nehemiah, and so you can tell we've been in this for a little while. And we called this series Into the Breach, because what had happened was there was the city of Jerusalem had been attacked, and in the year 586 BC, 586 years before the year zero, before Christ's birth, it was attacked by the Babylonian army, and it was a two-year siege, and they were able to break into the city and just tear it apart. They tore down the temple that Solomon had built. They broke down all the city walls, the gates of the city. There was no security for this city. There was nothing to protect it at all. And it didn't matter because there wasn't anything left there. And so we've called this series Into the Breach because there was this guy named Nehemiah. Now, Nehemiah had been, he had been working for the king in Babylon. And he's working there and serving him, and actually the Babylonians had gotten overtaken. Their empire fell and it turned into the Medo-Persian Empire. And so he's serving the king there in what's called the Citadel of Susa. It was the Babylonian capital that was now kind of the capital in that region for the new empire. And he's serving the king as what's called the cupbearer, which essentially means he's going to be the one that takes a sip of the king's wine or other drink first before the king drinks it to make sure nobody's poisoned it. Not the best, like, you know, hope for tomorrow if the king doesn't have a good popularity scale. You know, like if he's down in the polls for like the approval rating, there might be some people that want to do him in. And, you know, so you got to watch out for that. And you're like, every time you're like, I don't mind the wine, but I really hate the anticipation of what might happen after. You know, it's the foaming at the lips as I'm falling on the floor shaking as I'm dying, you know. But that would show the king, like, hey, don't drink that wine and set an investigation up because there's people that have it in for you. And so that was Nehemiah's job. But Nehemiah, he hears a report from some of his fellow men because for 70 years, the Israelites had been taken out of the land and out of Jerusalem in what's called exile. God had spoken about that through his prophets for a number of years. He said, if you guys don't start obeying me, if you don't start going back and following my law, you're going to be removed from this land. I'm going to take you into exile. And one of the things was he set the length of time as 70 years because that was 10 cycles of seven-year Sabbaths. Every seventh year, they were supposed to give the land a rest, not plant any crops. And that way, they were trusting God that the sixth year harvest was enough to last them, not only for what they needed in year six as harvest, but in year seven and into the year eight to plant and then have enough food until that harvest came in. So really year six covered 3 years worth of supply. And so that was part of what it meant to trust God that he was going to provide for them. The tithing principle is linked to that. When you say, okay, God, I live on 90% of what you've blessed me with because 10% goes back to you in trust that you can do more in my personal finances and in my home with 90% than I can do with 100%. That's the tithing principle, and the Sabbath principle is linked to that. We take one out of every 7 days off work because, well, some of you are retired, so it's like, I don't know how you figure that out, but a day set aside to just rest from any labors and say this is a day for recreation, for spiritual time of growth. And so you look at all those things and you say, okay, this relies on God, that God is going to bless me when I rest. God is going to bless me when I give back to him that portion that he has asked back from us. And so what they were doing was they hadn't been observing that seventh year rest. They hadn't been observing that seventh year Sabbath rest. And so for all these cycles that had been 490 years, that's 70 cycles of seven. For 70 of those cycles, they hadn't been observing it, and God said, I'm going to give the land its Sabbath rest all at once. So for 70 years, they weren't living there in the land, and they were carried into exile. But then God moved in the hearts of these pagan kings who weren't, they didn't worship God, they didn't honor God in their personal lives, and yet they were used by God as his tool to bring the Israelites back, and not only to bring them back, but to give them safe passage back to the promised land, to the Holy Land of Israel, to provide for them along the way for their journey, to give them blessings and gifts and encourage the people within the kingdom that had means to give them parting gifts. And it's funny because God did this once before when they left Egypt. If you're like a Bible nerd and pay attention to the details, and if you're not, then I'm your guy. I pay attention to them for you and give you these little details that you probably missed when you were reading the story. When the Israelites were leaving slavery in Egypt, they asked all of the Egyptians for like gifts and articles of gold and silver and clothing and food and all this stuff. And they're like, yeah, take whatever you want. Just please leave. We're tired of these plagues that are here on behalf of your God and your presence here. Just go. We'll pay you to leave. Some companies do that with some of their employees. They're so bad. They're like, here, we'll pay you to not work here anymore. Okay. Like take 6 months, take 3 weeks, whatever it is. Like take this severance package because it's not that we feel bad for firing you. We just want you gone and we'll pay you money if you sign this paper and say you'll leave us alone after this. Isn't it fun? That's the way stuff works still today. It's not that much different from back then. And so, sorry if you're on the receiving end of one of those severances and you just realized, it's kind of like when grandma would say like, oh, bless your heart. And then I learned like, that didn't mean she was saying something real sweet. It meant she was saying I did something really dumb, you know? If you lived in the South, you know what I'm talking about. And I don't mean geographically here in Florida. I mean like the South. You know, bless your little heart. It's like, okay, you did something really dumb, didn't you? So when I learned that, I'm like, oh man, I'm thinking back of all the time somebody said, bless your heart, you know, and I realized I made some dumb decisions at some point along the way. Well, the Israelites, they were in exile for 70 years and they start returning back to the land. Now, by the time Nehemiah gets there, the exiles had been back for a long time. They've been back into the land for about that many years in addition. And what all they had accomplished to do at that point was they had managed to rebuild the temple. There was a guy that kind of led the charge to do that. And he's probably since passed on. And there's a group of people that are kind of, some of them are living in Jerusalem, but the walls are still broken down. Some of them are living out in villages and surrounding countryside in their towns or just in the middle of nowhere. They have their own kind of like, leave me alone. I'm out here. I don't need anybody to stop and talk to me. You probably haven't met those people because they got a sign up that says like, no trespassing, violators will be shot. You know, people that survive that will be shot a second time. So like you've seen those signs. It's like those people, they just want to be left alone. So there were probably some of those folks too. They were Jews. They were Israelites. But they said, I don't want to live in that city. I just want my piece of land out here. I'm going to raise my animals. I'm going to grow my crops. I'm going to make my own clothes. Leave me alone. That's fine. And so you had all that going on. Until there's this guy named Ezra that comes back, and he's a scribe, which is a teacher of the law, and he starts trying to organize them in their worship practices. He says, if you live in this land, you're supposed to obey the word of God, the law of Moses. Then, a few years after him, Nehemiah is hanging out. He's the cupbearer to the king, as I had said. And he's hanging out in the citadel of Susa. His job's really quite easy unless he gets the short straw. You know, like other than that, that's not good. But sitting around and sipping wine for the king every day, not a bad gig. I don't know if he had other responsibilities, but for sure that was what he did. And so he gets a report, though, from some of his own countrymen, some Jews that had been to Jerusalem. And then they come back to the citadel of Susa and they say, hey, wait a second. It's not really going great for our countrymen over there. Like we thought it was going to be really good for them. We went and visited, and it turns out they're living in a lot of distress. The walls are still broken down in Jerusalem. There's no city gates. There's no order. There's no law. There's nothing really that they can count on for safety and security. And they're certainly not really utilizing the temple. There's cobwebs in it. It's dusty and dirty. They're using it for a storeroom for stuff. It's not a great situation. And so Nehemiah had been in great distress over this, and he spends actually about 4 months praying and fasting that God would show him what to do. Folks, no movement of God ever happens without prayer and fasting, right? It just doesn't happen. If you're saying, God, why aren't you moving? God, why aren't you healing our land? Why aren't you fixing our country? How much time have you spent on your knees? How much time have you spent in prayer? How much time have you spent face down before God saying, God, move me first. Fix my heart, fix my mind, renew the patterns of my thinking, renew the patterns of the thoughts of my heart and the motives of my heart. Give me the mind and heart of Christ. Until you spend time doing that, don't expect God to move in a big way in our area. But Nehemiah, he spends 4 months on his face before God in prayer and fasting, and then he shows up to the king one day to do his job. The king asks for wine. He comes and brings him wine. Excuse me. And he says, the king looks at him. Now remember, this king is not a righteous man. He's not a good guy. I said before, one of the things he did to secure his place on the throne was kill his own brother so that his brother wasn't a rival of his. Like, he was not a good dude to have as a friend. However, God used him. And God gave the king this understanding to look at Nehemiah, and he says, "What's wrong with you, my friend?" Well, I don't know if he called him friend, but what's wrong with you? There's something wrong. You look sick, but it's not an illness. It's a sadness of the heart. It's a sickness of the heart. It's in your soul. It's in the innermost core of your being that there's something sick within you. What is it? And Nehemiah, I love this. He says, "I prayed quickly that God would give me strength." He had already started that day out in prayer. And I think I remember it's been a couple months ago now that Nehemiah had woke up that day, I believe, with a fire in his belly. He said, "Today's the day. I've been on my knees, on my face before God for 4 months. And I'm not trying to push God to do something, but today is the day." So he said, "Lord, I'm going to go before this man, the king. Now give me favor today in his eyes." And so that's when the king noticed that he was sad. And the king said, "What is it? What can I do for you?" And he says, "Well, I'd like to go back to my home country." Nehemiah had never been there before. I don't know if he'd visited, but I mean, that wasn't where his roots were. Like, if people say to me, "Pastor Nick, where are you from?" I say, "Well, I grew up in a small town in Michigan, out in the sticks, out in the country." Like, just, we had a private road with 6 houses on it. It was rural. It was great. And then I moved from there down to Tennessee, and I lived in the city where people stole, like, everything. You know, if you left a gas can out with holes in it, they'd still steal it. You know, it's like, why, you know? So it's a great way to get rid of trash. You know, if you didn't have garbage service, is just leave it laying out by the porch and they'd take it. But anyway, it wasn't great if you wanted to keep your stuff, even if you had locks on it. Like, those are easy to cut, you know? And so I learned that the hard way. And so, I lived in Nashville, Tennessee for 11 years. And now I've been down here in Zephyr Hills for going on 11 years. And so that's kind of how my life has been divided up. But Nehemiah, if you ask him where he's from Babylon. Now, he knows his people, he knows his heritage, he knows his home country is truly Israel, is the promised land of God. But he hadn't really been from there, and yet he felt like he was from there. He identified with that. And so the king asked him, "What do you want?" And he says, "I want to go home, not forever, but for a while, and I want to rebuild the walls around the city." Now, this is a guy whose job has been, shall we say, cushy, easy. Like, "Here you go, sir. This wine is fine. It's pretty good wine, if I don't say so myself, sir. You've done a great job, you know, in procuring this." And now he's saying, "I want to go blue collar, get a suntan. I want to get out there and build some walls." "All right, have at it. How long is it going to take you? What do you need?" He's like, "Well, I literally need everything, and I need protection. I'm not a fighter, you know, like, so I need all this stuff. And can I get building permits?" That's difficult. Like, they don't give those out very easily. And so it's like, "Can I get building permits, supplies, money, a salary? Because I'm going to be the governor while I'm there." And the king's like, "Sure, sounds good. Are you going to be gone a long time?" He's like, "Probably a few years." "Okay, cool. Sounds good." And the king sends him on his way. Now, this can only be the hand of God at work. But Nehemiah, he goes out there. He takes a scope of the situation. He goes and starts gathering the people, first the leaders of the people, and he's like, "What are we doing here? We're in so much distress. All we have to do is rebuild this." And they're like, "Easy for you to say, bud." He's like, "Actually, it is easy for me to say. Look, I've got like a briefcase with all this stuff in it from, you know, provision letters and protection letters and authorization letters. We're good. Let's start working." They're like, "Yeah, let's do it." It took them 51 days to build it against much opposition. People were mocking them, which, that's words. Words can be hurtful. They can also be like, "Whatever, I don't care." And then, though, there was people trying to actually kill them. Now, I've been on some construction sites. I actually worked for a stonemason when I was 19 years old. I was never stronger than that season where I worked for him. I mean, we were lifting 200-pound rocks and buckets of mud. When I would first mix the mud or the mortar, we had poured into buckets, and I was like, trying to get it up on the scaffold, you know? And then after a couple months there, I'm just like, I would grab two of them and go, boom, boom. You know, I just pop them up there like, ah, oh, yeah, strong. I couldn't even dream of doing that right now, you know? I just like, oh, my back. Okay. It's probably why my back hurts from doing jobs like that. And so they get together. They do this hard work. But I know when I was there, the hardest thing we had to do was lifting heavy stuff. And like, it was in Michigan, so there'd be snow. And we put these tarps over our thing and put a heater in the bottom. So just trying to stay warm and dry. That was our biggest struggle. They had people fighting them for their life. So they had a sword in one hand and their tools or trowels in the other hand. That's like our little logo with the shovel and the sword. You know, it's like they had to fight to do their job. Most people won't even fight to keep their job, let alone, you know, like fight to do the job. So anyway, this was what they went through. They build the wall in 51 days, and then they go through a few different things. They restore proper the way they operate towards one another. They'd been charging interest to people on loans for the poorest of the land. They were taking advantage of other people. So they start working on all that societal stuff. They correct some of those injustices that had happened that they had been doing towards one another. And then they begin to work on reading the law of God. They recognize that they have sinned. They confess their sin. They go through celebrating the festivals that are at hand that the law of Moses had prescribed. And then we saw last week, they signed a covenant or a contract of basically saying, we will follow the law of Moses. Like all the stuff that the Israelites were already under covenant to do, we're reaffirming that covenant. Some of us might need a time in our lives where we say, you know, there was a long time ago that I can point to where I gave my heart to Jesus, but I've really kind of taken bits and portions of it back, or I've withheld portions of my heart from him. And I need to rededicate those things that I said I would do back then. I need to say, Lord, I really am ready to serve you in earnest. Whatever you ask of me, whatever your Holy Spirit reveals in my life, I'm going to give that back to you and give that up to you. So that's what they did in Nehemiah chapter 10. So we find ourselves here in Nehemiah chapter 11. And I want you, some of you might have flipped to that before, but we're going to look at it. I believe it's on like page, if you're using one of the Bibles in the rack in front of you, I believe it's on page like 536. Is that right? Yeah. So we're just going to read the first two verses. And then I got one verse for you a little bit later on. So the leaders of the people settled in Jerusalem, while the rest of the people cast lots to bring one out of every 10 to settle in Jerusalem, the holy city, while the other 9 remained in other cities. The people gave their blessing on all the men who volunteered to settle in Jerusalem. Now, the interesting thing is, there's this one verse when you flip further down, is down in verse 14. And it's in this list of names, and it's talking about them. And it says this one particular guy, says he and his colleagues who were, now, here's the problem. This Bible translation that I'm using is the NET. It's the same one that's in the racks in your pews. I like it for a few reasons, and there's some times where I don't like it, and today's one of those days. I got angry this week. I was already writing this message, and then I opened my phone, my Bible app one morning, and it was on the ESV. If you're not familiar, that's like kind of a ultra-modernization of the King James Version is the way I look at it. And the ESV said a phrase that I knew was right. So I started looking at all the translations. I studied some, but I never like had a Greek and Hebrew class, but I go back on a Bible app that I've got that tells you what the words were in Hebrew, and I confirmed what I knew was right, and the ESV got it right. See, this version, it says that he and his colleagues were exceptional men, 128 of them. Here's the problem with that. It's not what it says. It's not what it says. And I don't know why they translate it this way. And this is why it's good sometimes to read multiple translations and see what it's really trying to get at. And you know, nobody's going to lose their salvation over this mistranslation. Like none of you have been led astray into a cult or a false idol or something like that over it. But here's what's missing. What it really says is that there were mighty men of valor. Mighty men of valor. And as soon as I read that, it triggered something in my brain, a memory. I said, I know mighty men of valor. I want to go over some of those with you. I want to go over some of those mighty men of valor that we have. And they're going to be up on the screen. It's the next slide. Go ahead and hit it, Matt. So there we are. So David, King David had mighty men of valor. Now, I'm going to be using mostly the NET because that's the version that we paid to download on our Pro Presenter that puts the stuff up on the screen. And the thing is, I abbreviated some of them. So there's sometimes just words that are missing. Don't worry about it. You're getting the gist of it today. Like I kind of did the DeFord condensed version here. That's what we're really doing. So David's warriors, a guy named Jashobeam, killed 300 men with his spear in a single battle. These are going to be from 1 Chronicles 11 and 12, by the way. So this one guy is such a warrior. He kills 300 men with a spear in one battle. Now, I don't know. I've never killed anyone. To the best of my knowledge, I don't know. I don't think I've been responsible directly or indirectly for anyone's death. But I can only imagine that killing somebody with a spear is a lot of work because you have to push it in them, pull it back out, and find another guy. And that just seems like a lot of work. And he used a spear. Not to be too graphic, I'm sorry, but this is just how my brain works, okay? So what's our next one? What do we got next? There's a guy named Eleazar, and he was with David when the army retreated. So now you've got King David and Eleazar and the rest of the army chickens out and they leave. But these two guys make a stand in a barley field and they defeat a whole Philistine, like a bit of their army. That's awesome to me. Next one, what do we got? David, this is another time, David has been at battle, he's thirsty and he's laying down, they're resting. And he says, oh, I wish somebody would get me, it'd be just so nice if I had a drink from the pit or the cistern, the well, inside the village of Bethlehem. That's where David is from. He's had this water. He's a shepherd. He's been like taking care of sheep. He knows all the best spots. Remember Psalm 23, he leads me to green pastures. He takes me to cool water. Like David knows where to find the best water. And he says, right now I want water from the spring in Bethlehem. Now, I don't think he meant it. I don't think he was like, seriously, one of you guys go do this. But check out what happens next. Three elite warriors broke through the Philistine forces line. Their enemies were there. It was behind enemy lines. They bust through enemy lines, and then they drop this jug down into the cistern to fill it with water. Now, I can only imagine that the Philistines aren't just going to be like, oh, okay, fine, no problem. They're probably going to try to fight them. So while one guy's lowering a jug with rope down into the well, the other guys are fighting off the enemy army around him, and then they break out of there and try to get back to David, and they do. And they bring him this water, and he's like, where's this from? And they're like, the well in Bethlehem, you said that thing. And he's like, I mean, I didn't mean that. Like, thanks, guys. I can't drink this. And he pours it out. This is for my homies. If you don't know what that means, you're not in thug culture, I guess. I'm not either, but I still know what it means. Anyway, this is for my homies. He says, I couldn't do this. This is your lifeblood. Thanks for getting that, Tim. I appreciate it. this could have been your lifeblood. You could have died doing this. So he offers it up to God as an offering. I still don't know if that was a jerk move or not. I'd probably be a little ticked, like, no, literally, I could have died. You better drink that water, you know? I get that way when my daughter, like, finally at a restaurant is like, I'm going to eat a meal instead of just, like, the free chips and salsa or table bread or whatever. And she orders a kid's meal and then won't eat it because it's not just right for what she's feeling at the moment when it comes. And I'm like, there's another, like, what are kids' meals now? $7-$8? I'm like, ah, now I feel like I've got to eat it, you know, like, so that it's not going to waste. Anyway, what's the next one that we've got, Matt? There was Abishai. Now, by the way, Joab, it says Abishai is the brother of Joab. Joab had become the commander of David's army because David had gone to the city of Jerusalem, which was inhabited by a group of people called the Jebusites. And he goes there, and the Jebusites are like, you'll never get us. And he's like, we will, though. He's pretty self-assured about it. And so he says to his guys, he's like, whoever of you breaks into that city, you get to be the commander of my army. It's like a contest. And Joab's like, got it. He goes in, he breaks in. It doesn't really say how, he just does it because he's that cool. And David's like, you're the commander of the army now. In hindsight, it wasn't the best thing. Joab ends up doing a lot of murders, you know? And so David's kind of like, you guys will be the death of me, you guys. Well, Joab was his brother Abishai, was one of these three elite warriors that had broken inside and gotten the water from that well. Abishai, he killed 300 men with a spear, just like the other guy. That was real simple. All right, moving on. Next one. So there was, he became one of, no, what's this one say? From the three, he was given double honor and he became their officer. So Abishai wasn't one of the three, but he became their leader. So it's like when you need a special mission done, maybe one of those off the books, you know, kind of, you know, black budget missions where you're like, I don't need this in the official records. You talk to Abishai, you're like, Abishai, we need the guys. He's like, I got it. And they go and they take care of whatever needs to be taken care of for the king. And so he wasn't one of the three, but he's their leader. So what do we have next, Matt? We're getting down near the end of these. There's this guy named Benaiah. He's really cool. It says he performed great exploits. He struck down two sons of Ariel of Moab. Ariel, I don't know if you're familiar, like that was the Little Mermaid's name, I think. So that's kind of a weird girl name. And if you're a dude that has two sons and your name's Ariel, they've probably gotten made fun of a lot because their dad's got a girl name that's the name of a mermaid. I know my timeline's off on that, but just go with me here. I'm just saying they were probably tough. Like the boy named Sue, the Johnny Cash song, you know, he's like, I knew I wasn't going to be around, so I had to give you a name that would toughen you up. No Johnny Cash fans? Okay, man, you guys got to, all right, I'll move on. We'll cut that out too. Anyway, he killed these two guys that were their enemies. He also went down in a pit on a snowy day and killed a lion. I don't know why it matters that there was snow or how the lion had gotten in there. I think it was supposed to be a lion trap, but anyway, it didn't kill the lion. So he's like, that's cool. I'll take care of it. And he jumps down into the pit with the lion and kills it. He didn't have to. The lion's already in the pit. It's not going to hurt anyone. And he's like, nah, I'm going to do it though. So that's pretty cool, right? You guys aren't that excited. This is so exciting how awesome these guys are. Let's wrap this up, Matt. What do we have next? He even killed an Egyptian who was 7.5 feet tall. Like think NBA player height. You know, he's like that tall. This Egyptian had a spear as big as the crossbeam of a weaver's loom. I'm sure you understand exactly how big that spear was at this point. Next. These were the mighty men who helped David in battle. They are armed with bows and they could shoot arrows or sling stones left or right-handed. So this group of guys, see what they did, they were up to. Next slide. These were Gadites and they were military leaders. The least of these guys that could shoot bows left or right-handed or sling stones left or right-handed, the least of them could take on 100 men. Like the weakest one of them could take on 100 men in battle, and the strongest of them could take on 1,000 men in battle. That's quite a ratio. These guys are awesome. They had done something really cool. They went across the Jordan River when it was at flood stage and it would overflow its banks. They went across the river at flood stage. You know what that means? The rest of the army ain't coming. The rest of the army isn't coming. You're going across there, this elite force that can, you know, switch hand. You know, what do they call it in baseball? You know, switch hitter. They're a switch hitter, but with their weapons. These guys are awesome. And they just go over there and like, hey guys, we're here to fight you. And they're like, what? Why? And they're like, because we want your land. God told us it was ours, so we're taking it. And they just start kicking everybody out of these cities where they were pagans that were worshipped false gods. And they said, God told us this is our land, so get out of here. So the question really is, what does all this have to do with anything? What does all this have to do with anything? Were you thinking that yet? Fairy, I know you were. Okay, so that's good. First of all, I hate cities. Like cities, big cities. I hate them. I lived in one. Like I said, I lived in Nashville for 11 years. Part of that time was in the suburb of Hendersonville, Tennessee. So it was, you know, we were on a kind of a cul-de-sac road. That was nice. Nobody stole anything from me on that road. But then when I moved, we moved to take a church and we moved into this parsonage. It was this really nice historical place, but our neighborhood was 5 minutes from downtown Nashville. So we lived in the city and it was nice. They did steal many thousands of dollars of my stuff there. I had good insurance. Thank God for that. But like, here's a non-exhaustive list of things I hate about cities. Okay. You ready? Here we go. So first of all, there's just too many people, right? There's lots of crime, lots of theft, lots of all kinds of stuff. They overdevelop it and there's no natural areas. And the natural areas they do have aren't natural. They're man-made. It's like, okay, come on guys. That's not really how God would have made that park. You know, we made that park so we could feel like we're out in nature, but we're really not. It doesn't work. It's too loud. And if I hear your music, I don't like it. Even if it's something I like to listen to in my house, I don't want to hear it coming from your car stereo or from your open windows. Like, that's not cool. I don't like it. Most of the time, what they choose to listen to, I don't appreciate. I'm glad that the trend that they had here in Zephyr Hills a few years ago of these high school punks putting loudspeakers like you would have like at an auction or some loud, like a car lot where they'd call out like, hey, so-and-so, come back to the back lot. And it's just a loudspeaker, no sub, no mid-range, just that high-end, real high-end sound, like the tweeter kind of thing. It would be like that, but they would put them on the outside of their truck, hook them to their radio, and whatever they're listening to in the cab, we're hearing really loud, but it sounds terrible, absolutely terrible. Finally, one day, one of them comes by playing like, you know, Alan Jackson, Randy Travis, like he's got some of these old, you know, like older guys when country was still country, when it was still good music, when it still sounded like music. They would play in that, and it's like, I appreciate your taste. I still don't want to hear it at 7 o'clock through my windows. You know, they're like these windows here on the church are single pane. They're the crank out ones, so they really don't seal very well. And I hear every bit of it. There's a nightlife full of all kinds of everything that people can imagine that you might do wrong as a human being to yourself or to others, debauchery, the scriptures might call it, that's going on. And cities, I'm not saying that everybody that lives in a city does this, I'm saying that cities promote this. Cities have lots of opportunity for these things and is something that's calling and enticing to people constantly. Hey, come do this. Hey, come enjoy this. And like I've said before, sin, if it wasn't fun in the moment, people wouldn't do it. Sin is fun at the time when you're doing it most of the time. It's really enjoyable most of the time in the moment. But it's later on when we realize what it's cost us, what it's taken from us, what it is, how it has harmed us and those around us, that we recognize that sin is so bad. There's also these corporations. I'm not saying every corporation is greedy or evil, but there are so many that they seem to promote such greed and such evil that's going on. Let's go back one more. I wasn't quite done. They're supporting evil. They're doing all this stuff with their influence that they have. Cities a lot of times can be impersonable and inhospitable. Like there's videos you'll see sometimes online of people that'll say like, hey, look at this nice thing that somebody did to help a stranger. You know, they helped him out with this thing or that thing, or people are talking online how they finally met their neighbor and they borrowed a stick of butter or whatever. And it's like, that was, if not weekly, maybe daily where I grew up. We were constantly helping each other out, borrowing tools or helping with their lawn with their mower broke, or borrowing, you know, my mom would send me down to the neighbors on my bike with a bag or a container to get sugar or butter or flour, whatever thing that you forgot, you know, and then of course you would always bring some more back to them to replace it. And that's just how we lived. I'm like, that was the life where we lived, and now people are celebrating that as like something abnormal in the city, because it is abnormal, because cities aren't very personable and hospitable, normally speaking. And then here's the real thing. A lot of that's just me being crotchety about cities and my personal view. But cities, and this is actually the biblical view. And the interesting thing is Nehemiah comes from Babylon. And Babylon is talked about through the rest of your Bible after that. Through the New Testament, through the book of Revelation, Babylon is evil personified. Babylon is everything that's wrong with a city, but no matter what city it is, in fact, even Jerusalem in the book of Revelation gets called that wicked Babylon, because Jerusalem had taken a turn where it was just as evil as Babylon had been. It was just as wicked and idolatrous as Babylon had been. And Babylon signifies everything wicked and wrong with a city. And so the cities in our day are just the same. They tend to have these like political views, and cities, if you look at a map of voters, they tend to be very blue, very left and Democrat leaning. And I know there's a lot of Christians that say, well, I'm a Democrat. And I'm like, you're probably a Democrat from the way it was decades ago when they were helping the working class people, when they were helping people that were down and out. But some of the things that the Democrat Party stands for now on its party platform are just downright wicked and evil. And so you say, well, I can be a Christian and a Democrat. I say, maybe. I don't know. Sometimes it's hard to be a Christian and a Republican, or a Christian and a Libertarian. I'm not really trying to say one way or the other, like, oh, you have to vote this party or that party. But there are so many things that I say, these things come from that party, from the people that are pushing that party towards the far left of where it should be. And they're pushing it so far there. And these are things that are not congruous with the biblical viewpoint or from the heart of a Christian. And because of that, these cities, they tend to vote that way. cities tend to be deep blue in their voting records. And then you get out to the rest of the area, and we have to live with what they are. If there's more people that live in the cities of a state, those states tend to go that direction, and the rest of us have to live with that. And you might be quite moderate or central in your thinking, but you're like, well, now all this crazy stuff is happening, and I didn't vote for those things to happen, but now I have to live with it because these cities decided it is so. So, on our next slide, the main problem that we see is that cities tend to set the culture upstream from the rest of us. You know, like, there's a saying, like, you know, if you're camping and somebody's bathing upstream, you know, because you got to bathe where you can, don't get your water downstream from that, you know? Like, it's just a bad idea. There's probably bad stuff in the water. You should definitely bring a filter or one of those tablets. If you don't go camping, that's fine. I like camping. The problem is the things that are upstream, these corporations, these cities, they set the culture, and that flows downstream to us. People are influenced by all of this. Cities need mighty men and women of valor. We need that. So my big question when I look at this, and I see that in Nehemiah 11, those first couple of verses, it says there weren't enough people living in the city of Jerusalem. What was going on was they had rebuilt the walls, the temple is functioning, they've got all the servants in place, the people have committed to bringing all the things that are necessary for temple worship, the sacrifices, the wood for the altars, all the stuff. They're providing the tithes and the offerings throughout the land, they're collecting it in all their towns and villages. The Levites and the priests are bringing that into the storehouse of God so that the temple can function as it was designed to do. They're committed to doing all those things. There's one thing that's left. There's not enough people living in the city of Jerusalem. Jerusalem is underpopulated, and the ones that are there might be great folks, but there's not enough of them to keep it going. And the thing that I noticed, the very first three, four words is, the leaders of the people lived in Jerusalem. See, the people that held sway over the whole nation were living in the city, but they don't know what it's like. They don't grow their own crops. They don't build their own equipment. They don't provide much of anything. That ruling class still exists today. They get voted in, they have all this tenure in office, but they've forgotten what it's like to live with their feet on the same soil that we walk on. And so we say, man, those people in Congress, those people in the state Senate, those people in the governor's office, whatever it is, those people in the White House, all this stuff, these people don't know what it's like. They don't know what it's like to live like us, to struggle to find money for insurance because it's gone through the roof in Florida. Oh, they tried to send us money after the hurricanes, but here we are still struggling to figure out how are we going to pay for these things. You know, it really doesn't fix it. And so we say, okay, well, that's all fine and well, but you guys have lost touch with the reality that we live in. And yet somehow we have to follow your lead. And even when we do vote, we say, well, I have to vote for the lesser of the evils. I have to vote for the only ones that are on the ballot. I voted in the primary, but the person that raised more money was the one that won the primary, and now they're the best choice that I have. And so we look at all that stuff, and we look at city life, and we say, why in the world would anyone that's a mighty man or woman of valor move to a city? Because you've got the leaders there, and then they have this lottery where 1 out of 10, I guess the losers that won the lot, like the 1 out of 10 that got selected, you know, they get told you're moving to the city now. By the way, in a city, there's a lot of stuff you can't do. And I should probably cut this out because of time, but you know what? I love it so much, we're going to do it. In a city, there's a lot of stuff that men like to do that you can't. All right, let's go through this list. Rapid fire. I'm going to wrap this up. It's illegal to, like, you know, set up a gun range in your yard. By the way, most of these things are things that we did when I was growing up. We would do target practice in our front yard. The neighbors would come over. They'd do it too. It was a great time. You know, you can't go hunting in your yard in the city legally. You know, you can do anything you want. It's America, but I mean, legally, you probably can't. You can't have giant bonfires. I mean, we would have bonfires where we would fill up half of this sanctuary full of brush and stuff that we had cut up over the summer. And then we would burn it in the fall. It was a great time. Can't do that in the city. They call the fire department every single time and the police if you mouth off to the fire department, you know? They give you big tickets. Did you know the fire department can write you big tickets? They can. I almost got one once. Fortunately, I was polite and didn't mouth off, and they didn't write me a ticket. The cops don't like you doing burnouts on your street. Can you imagine that? They really don't like you doing that in the city. I know you guys aren't trying to do burnouts on the street. I did as a teenager. I thought it was great. Of course, we had a gravel road and it was real easy. And they really frown on you blowing stuff up. Yeah, they really don't like that. I don't mean like to be destructive unless it's your stuff that you want to destroy. Like if you have an old washing machine that doesn't work and you want to take it to the scrapyard, but first you want to blow it up and get to shoot it, you buy this product called Tannerite. It's not that expensive for the amount of fun you get out of it. You mix these two inert chemicals together and you put them inside the washing machine. You shoot it with a rifle. It has to be a rifle, not a handgun. It has to be a high velocity round, and it'll explode when it's impacted by a high velocity round. This is legal to buy. You can get it on the internet. Maybe even at Rural King today. You just can't do it here in the city, you know? And it will blow up. You need to stand far enough away that bits of the washing machine don't hit you. There's some fun videos on YouTube of people, I think they survive, but they ducked really quick when parts of it come flying at them. So just be real cautious when you do this in the country. You can't do it in the city. And even the suburbs are terrible. Sorry to some of you guys, but have you ever heard of or lived in an HOA? Oh my goodness, you know what an HOA stands for? Hateful, obnoxious authoritarians. There's always somebody that has too much time on their hands to just go around to the clipboard and be like, well, so-and-so had their garage door open for too long. The rules won't allow that. You didn't have a cover in front of your trash cans. My grandfather-in-law, Amy's grandfather, they told him that he needed to paint the boards that he'd put up to block his trash cans. So he painted them bright red because they didn't give him a color. And that was his way of telling him, nah, I do what I want, you know. I would not make it in an HOA, but I do have an idea for a good HOA that men, maybe a few women would like, all right? No, this HOA, this idea that I have is like, okay, so you go in, you pay your HOA dues, but here's what your HOA dues pays for. First of all, there's like an equipment rental, but it's free. You just have to sign equipment out. So if you want to dig a hole to put in a fence or whatever, you got the post hole diggers. If you need a bigger hole, you can like dig a trench with the excavator. You just sign it out. Whatever, there's all this equipment that you can sign up, but then there's a woodworking shop. You just bring your lumber in and they got all the tools and sanding equipment and all this stuff there. Then there's like an automotive shop because there's no limit on how many, like one of these days I'll get that car running projects. Some of you guys, you ever have those? I know a couple of us do. Like, I'll get that running one day. I'm not ready to get rid of it just yet. You can take it to the shop and work on it when you get around to it. It has a lift, it has an oil change bay. This is cool stuff, right? You guys aren't getting nearly excited enough. Then there's another one. It's the metal fab shop, you know, with torches and cutters and all the welders. It's a great time. This is just for me, huh? There's a gun range there, by the way. You can grow anything you want. You can have any animals for pets that you want. Huh? You can have any animals for pets that you want, except cats. Those are illegal. That's the only rule. No cats. This is the men's HOA thing, you know? The question is, with all that stuff that I've said, I said all that to say this. Why would mighty men of valor ever move to a city? Why would they do it? I mean, yeah, they lost the lottery, 1 out of 10. They could have said no, though. Who's going to fight them? They're the mighty men of valor. Who's going to tell them no? I'm staying out there in my don't bother me, don't mess with me unless there's a fight, unless there's a battle. But I think mighty men of valor recognize that even in the city, there's a big fight going on. There's a battle to be fought that doesn't involve weapons of war, but it involves weapons of prayer warriorness. See, we have to recognize that there is a spiritual battle for the lives of the people around us that's going on right now. And in the city, it's amplified. Oh, sure, we got problems in rural areas. And I don't know where Zephyr Hills fits in this because it's like 15 times larger than I would like to live in for a city. It's just way too big. But nevertheless, you've got these problems in cities of all sizes. You got, of course, theft and drugs and all that stuff. I get it. Human trafficking is a huge thing. It's all going on. But somewhere in the city where the culture is set and where the people are following that culture downstream, we need people that will rise up and say, not in my city. In my city, I'll stand and I'll fight that spiritual battle. I'll spend time on my knees and on my face in prayer. I'll vote. I'll stand up in city meetings or school board meetings or whatever it is. I might run for office if I have to. I'll do all these things because I'll be the one that stands up and fights that battle. I'll be the one that says, not while I'm still here. That's not going to happen while I'm here. And the leaders can all live in the city and try to tell us how to live. But we're going to stand on the word of God and say, no, this is how I live, and I'm not going to be governed by things that are immoral against the will of God. See, mighty men of valor, mighty women of valor. Valor in this case is it's not just people that are you don't have this like pride or arrogance that says, look at me, look how strong I am. It's a humble person who's willing to step up when the need arises. Sure, you might get some glory from winning the battle, but you reflect all that praise and glory to God because you want to see souls saved, because you don't want people to go to hell. And the cities are leading people to hell, whatever that city is, whatever that structure is, that authoritarian structure that sets this culture that we tend to follow. We look at that and we say, I'm not going to stand for that anymore. Too often we fought that stand within the church and we said, okay, it's just we're going to make sure that we're strong and that we have our own walls that protect us from all that stuff outside. But we don't go and fight that battle outside. We don't wake up in our homes in the morning and get down on our knees before God and say, Lord, there's a battle going on. Use me to fight as one of your mighty people of valor today. We need them to stand up. And by the way, for those of you who think, well, somebody that has more energy, more years, more strength, more wisdom, more knowledge left than I do, they can stand up and fight that battle. I got one last little story. I'll be as brief as I can. There's this guy named Gideon. You can read about him if you go back to the book of Judges chapter 3 and the next few chapters after that. Because you see, I found out there's a few more people that are called a mighty person of valor in the Bible. There's even a non-believer named Naaman who has leprosy, and he's a Syrian enemy of the people of Israel, and yet he was considered a mighty man of valor, and then he gets to know the one true God, and he serves him. You got other people like Joshua, by the way. Joshua that leads the people after Moses dies, he leads them into the promised land of Israel. He's called a mighty man of valor, which he didn't really think that he was that strong. But you've got this guy, Gideon. Gideon, at the time, Israelites are once again being oppressed. This is hundreds and hundreds of years before our story with Nehemiah. Gideon is afraid of the Midianite army who has held sway over the Israelites. And Gideon is down in a wine press because he's hiding as much as he can from the Midianites, and he's threshing grain. He's trying to get to retain a little bit of the harvest that he's worked so hard for, because the Midianites were stealing everyone's grain that they could find and starving the Israelites out. And he's down there, he's hiding, he's doing it probably at night or at sundown so that he can't be seen. And the angel of the Lord shows up. You know what he says? I thought for so long it said, "Greetings, mighty warrior." That's what my translation said. It's not what it says. He says, "Greetings, mighty men of valor." Gideon's like, "Me? Not me. I'm not that strong. I'm hiding here. I'm the weakest in my family line. My family's the weakest in our clan. Like, I'm not a mighty man of valor." He says, "Oh, yes, you are." Later, he tells him, "Go in the strength that God gives you." So that's my challenge to you all today. You might say, "I'm not a mighty person of valor." Oh, yes, you are. God has called you to do this. You go in the strength that he has given you. And you go and you say, "Lord, I'm your vessel, willing to fight wherever you call me to, fighting against the evil and demonic forces that threaten to take the lives and the eternities of our friends, family, and neighbors around us." And you say, "I won't do it on my watch. I won't let it happen on my watch. I'm going to fight for just one more, for just one more." Are you willing to stand up for that? Are you willing to be that mighty person of valor today? Ask God how you can do that and spend time on your face every day.